Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Wednesday, July 3rd, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Wednesday, tomorrow, Thursday, 4th of July, brings up the question, what's the best day of the week for a holiday to fall on? I have the answer. I think it's Thursday, and I'll tell you why. So first, let's start with the worst. Wednesdays are the worst. It's an island. You don't automatically get the preceding 2 days or the subsequent 2 days. You may, but it's not automatic. It's just this little island of respite. The next worst day for a holiday is actually Sunday, because Sunday holidays are a little redundant. Most of the benefits of a holiday are subsumed by it being Sunday. Now, you do get the day off on a Monday, so the 3-day weekend is alive. But you know what? Most days of the week that a holiday can fall on, you do get a 3-day weekend. You get it if a holiday falls on a Sunday or a Saturday or a Friday. What am I forgetting? Or a Monday. Yes, thank you. So I would say the Monday, Saturday, Friday, that's all tied as being the next best day for a holiday to fall on the list. But I think really you're down to Tuesday or Thursday. It's got to be one of those 2 days to be the best day for a holiday to fall on. Because what happens is you either get the day before or the day after almost all the time. I mean, the New York Stock Exchange automatically gives it to you off. By you, I mean you, the traders on the New York Stock Exchange. And you get a 4-day weekend. Also, what's really nice about the 4-day weekend is that other day, so a Friday if the holiday falls on a Thursday or the Monday if it falls on a Tuesday, usually a lot of things are open. You could get a lot done. So it really comes down to this. Would you rather work, then have your 4 days off, or have your 4 days off, then work? I'll tell you what the answer is. Obviously, you want the Thursday holiday. I mean, do you quaff your Michelob Ultra before your workout or after? Exactly. Thursday's the best day for a holiday to fall on. Now, here's a related question, less clear answer. When it's a 3-day weekend, what's the best part? Is it the 3 days off or the 4 days on? Duh. How could it be the 4 days on? No, you don't get me. What do you like better? The fact that you get 3 days in a row not working, or that you only have to work for 4 days? There is a rigorous way to test this, actually. Let's say we redefine the weeks, and a week could either be 6 days with a 4 days on, 2 days off schedule, or a week could be 9 days with a 6-workday followed by a 3-day weekend all the time. Which would you prefer? It's the same amount of work in a year. It's a 2-to-1 ratio. Would you rather work for 4, off for 2 consistently, or work for 6, off for 3? Don't get jammed up with the, whenever I work for 4, I got to cram all the work in that I usually get. No, you're stuck in the 7-day week mindset. The parameters that I've presented to you are the correct ones. I am positing a different reality. Expand your mind. Love will win. 6-day week on the 4-2 schedule, or 9-day week, structured 6-3. I don't know. I'm interested to hear what you would say. I think I'd go with the 4-2, but I might go with the 6-3. And then you have the question of, what do you name the extra 2 days of the week in your 9-day work week? Historically, days of the week are named after gods and goddesses, so I'd guess we'd have to go with something like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Beyonce Day, something like that. But you know what I'd like? I'd like an actual day of the week to be named Hump Day. Of course, if we were on the 6-3 schedule, there'd be no actual Hump Day, but I'd still want to formally enshrine a Hump Day for all your work-related or avocational humping needs. On the show today, I spiel about throwing around the old horse hide. No, not the actual carcass of an animal, but close. An examination of the sport of baseball as experienced via the ear. But first, C-SPAN, the greatest TV network in TV network history, has been exploring all the branches of government for years. But the presidency, that holds a special place in the hearts of C-SPAN, despite the fact that the network began 40 years ago by broadcasting from the floor of the House of Representatives. Can you imagine if Millard Fillmore had access to the airwaves, or either Harrison, Benji, or Willie? The mind reels. Brian Lamb, C-SPAN's founder, and Susan Swain, C-SPAN's co-CEO, are here with their new book ranking all the presidents, or at least the first 44 before the current guy ruined it forever. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, we're counting down the top 43 chief executives of the United States. Start with James Buchanan all the way up to number one, Abraham Lincoln. We're right now on number 37. Coming in with a bullet, it's Millard Fillmore. All right, would that be more exciting than what I've got before me, which is a book called The Presidents, Noted Historians Rank America's Best and Worst Chief Executives? I think not, because The Presidents is put together by the brain trust that runs C-SPAN, and C-SPAN has been ranking the presidents for years, and how some of these rankings have changed is quite interesting, as is the contents of the book. It is based on interviews that Brian Lamb of C-SPAN did with noted presidential biographers. The editor of this book is Susan Swain. Brian and Susan are here with me. Thank you for joining me, guys.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
So let's start. I'm sure this is where everyone starts, but fine. Chester A. Arthur. I think he's unfairly maligned. Here's my case for Chester A. Arthur. You know, you only have to be president in the time that you have to be president. Abraham Lincoln had a great war upon him. George Washington, of course, was the father of the country and the first president. Given the job that Chester A. Arthur was handed, I think he left the country better off. If I had to file a performance review of Chester A. Arthur, it would be quite a glowing review. I think he exceeded expectations. Do you agree or disagree?
Absolutely. I think we ought to say up front that the most important part of this book, Mike, are the authors of these books that we interviewed. It's really a book about presidents and historians more than it is a book about ratings. The ratings thing is fun to do, but in the end, all of these individuals deserve credit for having led the country.
So two of the presidents who've had reassessments, not just from your panel of historians, but historians in general, are Andrew Jackson and Ulysses S. Grant. And the reason for the reassessments is similar. It's mostly in the treating of African Americans, or even broader than that, in Jackson's case, Native Americans, African Americans. And my question is that fair in terms of history, or is that more a reflection of the current mores of our time?
Well, of course, we can really only judge them through our own eyes. I mean, that's understandable. And One of the things, even in the 20 years that we've been doing this survey, watching certain presidents go up and down, it's because our society has been changing so much during that period of time that the lens through which historians, even though they have some sort of professional distance in the process, they're human. And they're reading new biographies that are coming out and working off of new papers. But around them, our own standards are changing. And so how we view these presidents and their performance has to be colored by that to some degree. You know, one of the categories, we did 10 categories in this survey, which was developed by presidential historians. And one of them was performance within the context of their times.
Yeah.
And that was intentionally added to give them a bit of a pass, I'd say, for the fact that the presidency was very different and the time in which they served and the country was very different.
Also, Mike, on Ulysses S. Grant, I can't even speak, there have been four or five major books written in the last 10 years.
Yeah, Turnout, one of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Turnout, Ronald S. White did a brilliant book a year before Turnout did. There's also the John Marsalek, it's annotated memoir, and it goes on and on. There are many other Grant books. They seem to have had also a major impact on his image.
Yes. And I do think that we have begun to, I mean, this is my opinion, but we've begun to rightly prioritize that one category that you had, which is, how do you guys put it, treating Americans as equals?
Yes. In fact, we do. It's pursued equal justice for all.
Right.
So several of the presidents, include Jackson, you mentioned, is one of them. But also Rutherford Hayes' rating has gone down. And I think he is tarred with ending the South after the Civil War, bringing their troops back home. And actually, the circumstances surrounding that decision were much more complicated when you read history about it, but is his reputation during his presidency. Another one is Grover Cleveland. And Cleveland, you'll learn in our chapter on him, really had a pretty poor record on race issues. So I think there are several presidents, again, judging through contemporary society when people are looking at them, that say, hey, they didn't do so well.
Brian, I know that you served in the, generally speaking, you were like a body man for LBJ, but Eisenhower was very much present in your lifetime. You thought about him. Are you surprised that he's so well regarded by history? He's the fifth greatest president, according to the historians in your book.
I am not surprised based on what I felt about him when I was young. The only part about him that I do remember, I mean, I remember him being in the public media. There are two things that he was known as being boring. And so that often is the wrong way to judge anything. The other thing was he had serious health problems, a couple heart attacks. He was in the hospital a lot. But those were 8 fairly peaceful years. And so it depends on, again, what is it you want. You can, being fifth, I don't think in terms of where presidents belong, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And I don't judge them based on where they fit in this survey. So he was a solid American, successful president with one major scandal, his chief of staff, and otherwise, pretty successful time.
Brian, how many presidential biographies would you say you've read in your life?
Well, I can tell you that he's read 43 of them.
At least, right?
Right, because they're all in the book.
Right. Well, in the case of Grant, I read 3 or 4. By the way, I love reading them. I'm not a historian, and I don't consider myself an expert in any of this. It's just really fun to get to know the country through these characters. I did something that is very strange. Most people would look at me like I'm crazy, and I might be. But I went to all the grave sites of all the presidents, and then I followed up by going to all the grave sites of all the vice presidents.
Wow.
And, yeah, people go, really? Get a day job. Do something. But it was a great teaching tool for me because I kind of, I get a feeling for where they are in the country and what the atmosphere was and all that stuff. And along the way, you learn a lot. But it's I just remember back as you were talking about President, my father really didn't like I don't know if the word hate is it, but didn't like Harry Truman.
Huh.
And if he were alive today, he would love Harry Truman because Truman is very popular in our survey. And when it's one of the most interesting lives of all the presidents, and he doesn't get talked about much. But when you get into it, he really made decisions and was strong about his decisions. And he's just got one of the most interesting stories of any of them.
And what's amazing about Truman is it really demonstrates the impact that one book can have on a president's reputation.
That's true.
David McCullough. Really, it had people revisiting his presidency because he was really very unpopular when he left office.
When you talk to the biographers, do you get the sense, it is usual, and Cherno even admits this, that he wouldn't want to spend time with someone he didn't like.
Yeah,
and then there's
right.
a little bit of a Stockholm syndrome where if you spend so much time, you perhaps begin to see the good in that person. So do you notice an inclination for most biographers to like their subjects? And then in terms of an honest assessment, what do you do, for instance, say, Brian, when you're interviewing those biographers?
Well, Brian, talk about Robert Caro, because you've done four at least major interviews with him, and all of his adult life almost has been spent in the study of one president. But he's not in love with him.
I don't want to be flip about this, because Robert Caro is a man that everybody that's interested in biography knows, and they have their very strong positive feelings about the work he's done. I don't think he's made up his mind what he thinks about Lyndon Johnson. I think that's part of his struggle to get the last of the five books out. Mm. He knows he doesn't like what he did in Vietnam, but he hasn't written that part of it yet. He knows he loves what he's done with civil rights, and he's written that. So, you know, it depends on the person. Some of these people are totally in love with their subject. It's an important part of studying a biographer, and when you read these books, you need to dip farther than what's on that paper to get some idea of why they felt so strongly to spend as long as – sometimes as much as 14, 15 years. One of our special people in this book is Richard Norton Smith, who's a historian that's written books from George Washington to Colonel McCormick, the former owner of the Chicago Tribune, is currently working on the definitive biography of Gerald R. Ford. And – I've never asked Richard whether he loves or likes or hates. I know he doesn't dislike him because he did the eulogy at his funeral. So
yeah, and he'd also be the first person ever to dislike Gerald Ford. Yeah.
That's a very good point. But he is fussing over Gerald Ford right now, going through 25 chapters to write about his life. And he's just fascinated, as close as he was to him, he's just fascinated by what he's finding about his ordinary beginning, extraordinary life that most people don't know about, to what he was as a president. So it varies. It depends on the situation. But you need to go beyond just reading the book. You need to think through whether or not a biographer really hates or likes who they're writing about.
Your question reminds me of the Bill Clinton chapter. We used David Marinus's biography, First in His Class, as the basis for that chapter. And the very last paragraph in our chapter from Brian's interview really speaks to this. He says, "The hardest thing was to decide in my own mind what I felt about this guy. I'd go back and forth violently because there were chapters in his life where I liked him and chapters where I didn't. So I would beat myself up saying, 'Make up your mind, you've got to decide.' And then I realized he's a dual person and I had it right."
Yeah. Ambivalence is sometimes a great narrative force if you're masterful enough to be able to communicate that to the reader. Let me ask you a couple C-SPAN questions. 40th anniversary, and I love C-SPAN. Do you think that – I've heard you in interviews say this – that your coverage of the correspondence dinner, especially putting it on C-SPAN and seeing Seth Meyers make jokes and seeing Donald Trump get upset with this, do you give some credence to that – the idea that that might be one of the things that inspired him to run for president?
Everybody writes this. We've never said it. That was some video that has been used many, many times of Trump sitting at the table and President Obama working him over in the crowd. But who knows? I think more than anything, the vision that the country has gotten about the White House Correspondents' Dinner has not worked to the benefit of the correspondents. And I've been in this town for 53 years. I don't go to them anymore. I'll never go to another one if I don't have to for some reason. I don't think that that's what journalists should be doing. Never did. But I think it's important for the country to see what it's like. 3,000 people all dressed up in a room. Their sources are there. There's a lot of drinking that goes on. It's just not a healthy environment if you call yourself a journalist.
And they've tried to go back to basics this year by having Ron Chernow speak. Because they were doing some self-examination. But you know that scene that you describe would have happened whether or not a camera was in the room. there were 1,100 or 1,200 people who mattered to Donald Trump and to President Obama at the time who all would have heard those same jokes. So the right. question is, did the camera make a difference, or really was it the – if this scenario is as influential as people write, would it have happened simply by virtue of them being in that setting, camera or no camera?
I interviewed a friend of mine, Steve Kornacki, who wrote a book, The Red and the Blue, the 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. He's not the first to put this forward, but he really emphasizes and underlines the importance of C-SPAN in the rise of Newt Gingrich, how he used C-SPAN and the fact that they would just televise his speeches on whatever. And he used that as a platform to help gain power. Do you put much credence in that idea?
Well, I'll tell you something that's never been written before, and I, you know, historians might be interested in this, but one day Newt Gingrich was in the lobby of our building, and, you know, we started chatting. I mean, I'd done a number of interviews with him and all that, and he said, "Do you know who I was really talking to on the floor of the House of Representatives when C-SPAN started in 1979, 1980, 81? It had to be 81. And I mm-hmm. said, "No, who was it?" He said, "I was talking to the staff at the White House. I wanted the Reagan staff to hear my ideas. That was more important to me than anything." I'd never heard that before, and I've never heard it since, because the general view is that he used that to whip everybody into shape from his point of view, created the Conservative Opportunity Society, then got the leadership in 1995 and went on from there. I don't think there's any question the fact that the House of Representatives went on television was a help to him, and he would say that himself. He said it many times, help to him in getting his message out.
So here's my last question. This is just about my favorite thing with C-SPAN, which is one of my favorite things overall. A presentation or a committee, someone testifying before a committee will end. And the people who were testifying will think that they're off mic and off screen, but the mics are still on and the mics pick up snippets of conversation. Do you have a favorite of anything that's ever been said and picked up that way?
Well, I'm going to let Brian answer, but you should have, if you were here in the studio with us, you would have seen him raise his arms up high when you describe that, because Brian has been such a champion throughout our 40 years of the before and after the gavel comes down.
Yeah.
So we're gavel to gavel coverage and a little more is what it boils down to. And you really see beyond the facade of the show of Washington when in those moments. Brian, do you have a favorite among them?
Actually, my favorite moment about the last 2 minutes of any hearing was one day I got a call from Meg Greenfield, who was the editorial page editor of the Washington Post. I did not know her. I had never met her. And she said, "Could we have lunch?" And she was very powerful in this town, much more powerful, I think, than the editorial page is today. And I said, "Sure, I'd be glad to. And when we got to lunch, first thing she said to me, "The most important thing about C-SPAN is the last 2 minutes of every hearing. I just love it." And so consequently, that was for me a very strong positive feeling, because I think I got my education in Washington by going in the hearing room and watching it for myself. And when a chairman or a ranking member comes off the dais after they've just been pounding on some witness and goes mm-hmm. up and backslaps and shakes hands and knows that the next fundraiser is just around the corner, it's very important for the public to see that. I'll just leave it at that.
And can I tell you, Mike, that when we hire new producers, it's one of the first things that they want to cut, because conventional TV rules are the event's over, we're on to the next thing. And we really have to work with people to say, no, let it breathe.
That's the gold.
It's true. And thank you for mentioning it, Mike. That's a victory.
You made Brian's day.
So awesome. The name of the book is The Presidents: Noted Historians Rank America's Best and Worst Chief Executives. It was put together by Brian Lamb and Susan Swain, the founding CEO and co-CEO of C-SPAN, now in its 40th year. Thank you.
What a fun conversation. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Megan Sachs.
And I'm Dr. Amy Sloshberg.
And we're the host of the podcast Campus Killings. Our show covers some of the most sinister crimes to take place on or around school campuses, or the cases we discuss have a school-connected theme.
And with the new school year comes an all-new second season of Campus Killings, which will debut on September 16th, 2023.
But if you want to listen to Campus Killings now, you can binge all the episodes from season one, available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
And now, the spiel. I'm not sure what you're going to be doing on your fourth, but I like to throw around the old horsehide in the backyard and pretend I'm Tris Speaker. You know, baseball is a part of America. Am I right to say boring, getting even more boring over the years part? And I like it. I like baseball. I like it because nostalgia and uniforms and lingo. Hey, hey, little bingo! And also arm angles and launch velocities. I like all those things. But you know why I really like baseball? It's because I only experience the upside to baseball. I am a Mets fan, and they usually stink. And this year they stink, and it doesn't bother me. A couple of years ago, they made the World Series, and I liked it. This year they won't, and it's fine. I just like the good stuff. Other sports tend to bother me more. You invest more in a football season, the team breaks your heart. Baseball doesn't do that to me. Baseball is so omnipresent, getting mad at it is a little like getting mad at the weather. There's another weird aspect to baseball. Unlike every other sport I enjoy it more through the ears than through the eyes. Baseball's appeal on radio is well known, but I almost always would rather listen to a good baseball podcast than watch or spend at least the same amount of time watching an average baseball game. My friends at Effectively Wild did a great podcast the other day. They interviewed the Dodgers pitcher Ross Stripling about several of his duels with great hitters over the years. It was more compelling than watching an actual Ross Stripling pitching appearance. I know, you're saying more compelling than the real Ross Stripling? Indeed it was. I mean, it was the real Ross Stripling. He just wasn't pitching. He was talking. You know, maybe part of it is that I listen to podcasts at double speed. And if you watch a game in double speed, most of the time, it's pretty much still nothing happening. And then when something happens, it happens too fast to actually watch it. There's another way to experience baseball that I really like via the ears, and that is sports talk radio. They, or the greats of sports talk radio, can take an anodyne moment, and most of them in baseball are, and infuse it with import. And that's what I was getting at today for a piece I did for NPR. I would like to air it here, a version of it, a little bit expanded version of it, some extra in there for the Gist listener, who will follow me down some odd pathways that the average NPR listener might object to. Anyway, here now is a pay-on to Mike Francesa, New York radio icon, /blowhard, /savant, /policer of playing the game the right way, and ultimately, entertainer. The Mets' 83rd game of the year, played last Thursday, will not be looked upon as an inflection point. The Mets had just lost three games in a row to the Phillies in a manner both dramatic and predictable. The Mets get a lead, Phillies stage a comeback, Phillies win the game. But last Thursday's game promised to follow a different script.
That's the biggest hit the Mets have had this year.
Sports radio station WFAN's Mike Francesa was on the air doing his daily show. Now, no player, coach, or general manager has lasted as long in the New York market as Francesa, who over the decades has attempted to enforce some accountability to all those who wear the uniform of any New York team. And as the dean of sports talk radio watched this game on a monitor inside his radio studio, the Mets' Todd Frazier hit a ninth inning home run to put the team up by two.
Frazier pumped blood into the Met corpse.
Francesa builds drama, concocting hope from near hopelessness. This could be a big win for the Mets. They could head into their upcoming series with the Yankees, having momentum. He doesn't dwell on the rational. Folks, this is a team that's seven games under 500. Let's be real. He gives voice to the emotional.
You cannot lose this. Not this game. This game has to be the Mets. Case closed.
The Mets relievers had to shut down the Phillies. Just had to get out of the inning. Now listen as the game unspools before him.
This game has got to be the Mets. It's tied.
Yes, because of this.
In the air to left center field. Going back on it is McNeil. It is gone!
And so was Francesa.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. can't happen.
He screams. He laments. He becomes fixated on the Phillies player who hit that home run.
Was this the 82nd time Frankel's hit a home run in a big spot against the Mets?
Francesa notes Frankel's particular prowess against the Mets.
I have no idea why that kid bats eighth, because every time he comes up, he gets a big hit. So I don't watch the Phillies every day. I have no idea. But the kid, every time he comes up against the Mets, he gets a home run.
Yes, Frankel seems to have done well against the Mets.
And five of his home runs have come against the Mets this year. Every time I see him, he gets a home run against the Mets.
Francesa goes on to note,
all he does is kill the Mets.
And in a bout of what a literary critic might note as repetition for emphasis, says this.
This guy hits 216. What does he hit? 800 against the Mets? Every time he comes up against the Mets, he hits a home run. They're showing all his home runs here. Every time you turn around, he hits a home run against the Mets.
Francesa continues to describe the action to his radio listeners, who, to be clear, could listen to the regular official game broadcast just one click away on the radio dial, but would rather stick with Francesa's show, an alternative universe of heightened stakes. Turned out to be the more rewarding choice as the inning continued and Philly slugger Jean Segura stepped up to the plate.
Let's see if he can get Segura out first. Segura hits a shot.
Yes, he does. Here's what happened.
Out to left field. McNeil going back. It is gone!
To Phillies broadcaster Tom McCarthy, unbelievable! To Francesa,
unbelievable!
Sports talk radio is id, exaltation, and catharsis. It also gives voice to rage, a rage more articulate, or at least more amplified, than the frustration that one fan can muster in isolation. Think of it this way. No matter what theology officially teaches, when the clergyman offers his prayer, it does seem more likely to reach God's ears. Francesa performed this function last Thursday.
This is a disgrace. I can't even believe it. You can't lose this game. They stink so bad, you can't even make it up. 37-45. Diaz goes down and gives up two homers and five runs after Frazier hits the clutch home run of the year to keep this team breathing.
Had the Mets won, they would have had a record of 38 wins and 44 losses, just as certainly the same sad, desultory, and underachieving team they are. But had they won, we would have been denied one of the great clutch performances of the year. Not on the mound, but on the mic. And that's it for today's show. You have Pierre Bien-Aimé and you have Daniel Schrader. They're producing The Gist. You never hear about them producing anything else. They must not produce anything else for anyone every day. I hear them on The Gist every day. Do they even produce? Do they produce for anyone else? Just The Gist. Okay, can't make this stuff up, folks. TJ Raphael is senior producer of Slate Podcast. I'll tell you what, folks. Should be better off walking home up I-95. I'll tell you that. You cannot call yourself a senior producer and then walk the leadoff man. If you'd like to subscribe to the Gist newsletter, and I recommend you do so, go to slate.com/gistnews. Every Saturday, we will summarize all the shows that aired that week and answer a trivia question. What trivia question? I'll tell you. What president of the United States, at the time of his death, was actively considered a traitor to the United States of America? Slate.com/gistnews. And if you'd like to listen to the Slate program, What Next? And I do recommend it. Today's show concerns NYC public advocate Jumaane Williams. Public advocate is an elected position. He actually becomes mayor if the current mayor cannot do his duties by, I don't know, sleeping in the case of Bill de Blasio. On What Next, Jumaane talks about desegregating New York City schools and also a little bit of his personal history, how he overcame Tourette's to become really quite eloquent. The Gist, back after this. Oom-pura-da-pura-do-pura, and thanks for listening.